Welcome to Emotionally Correct, a hilarious DEIA podcast with Kelton and Charisse from IDEA.
The last episode ended with, you know, you had gone on and on and on and on about your life.
Yeah.
Because you are older than me, and so that took a long time. And I don't think we even had begun to scratch the surface of.
Well, that's not exactly true. You ended up in high school with reflections towards college, and I was like, well, wait a minute, that was fair.
That's actually true.
Yeah.
So theoretically, did I finish?
I don't know. I think there are things we should probably go back and explore, given your upbringing. I mean, and look, maybe this is something we should talk about, man. I mean, maybe being white is less layered. I mean, I don't think that's the case, but somehow your story, it didn't involve much interaction with people of color or thoughts of people of color. So the story becomes truncated in this context, right? Because you don't have a lot to say about it, you know?
No.
Your family wasn't sitting around saying, let's stick it to the man and the blue-eyed devil and, you can't trust Whitey. So, and here's the thing, I think your family was of such a makeup that they didn't speak ill of people of color, apparently. I'm not hearing you say that. They just didn't speak of people of color. So they didn't exist.
No, and they didn't overtly speak poorly of, maybe they did. I don't want to throw my parents under the bus, but I think that they, if there was any negative talk in my household, it was centered on people's less educated.
Yeah.
As if there was this conscious decision on the part of poor folks to put themselves in situations to be and stay poor. And the being and staying poor was much related in my parents' mind. If you had simply done well in school and taken a path towards education, towards white collarness from blue collarness, I mean, that really was, it wasn't white versus black in my house, it was white versus blue.
And is that, however, or although, or and, kind of this undercurrent language of race, right? Because those individuals who are more likely to fall into that blue collar category in that period of time were people of color who did not have access to either the same opportunities of education or the quality of the education. So without them, and let me take a time out because I don't want you to feel as if you're throwing your people under the bus, right? I think this is where we were, we're talking about historical things, and this is where society was. There wasn't any malice on their part in thinking this way about people with means or ability to work hard.
I don't think there was malice per se. I think it was meant as a motivator for my sister and I to like get an education, and that education was the way out of poverty. I think I will say that while it is true that we did not sit around contemplating the same, we don't have the same layers related to the black-white conversation that you might have had in your household. I do think, and there have only been a few resources in my racial equity journey that I've read that actually unpack the hierarchy of whiteness. You know, you have colorism, right? In one way, right? In the black community, in the white community, among people who came here starting in the late 1800s, which was the first influx, giant influx, right? Of basically non-British people. There was a hierarchy among immigrants. And so I think that my parents' concepts of isms sat in a class conversation that intersected with understanding that Italians were lower on the race hierarchy than, for example, Germans. who were among the highest on the race category of whites, right? And so I think that one of the conversations I bore witness to as a kid growing up was within my own family, a disdain for people who held on to their Italianness, either through language. So, you know, my great aunt had been in this country for like 50 years, and she still spoke with a very thick accent, not just an accent, but she spoke in what my parents called broken English. And there was disdain, there was some disdain for that. Like, assimilate already. And then the next level, that sort of next generation, which was my parents' generation, among my father and mother and their cousin, their sort of cousins, people that age, there was discussion or disdain around they could have gone to college, but they didn't. They still held on to some Italianness. I remember my uncle had a, he sold RVs, and he made a very successful life for himself as an RV salesman, had a huge company. And he had this little commercial in which he took a common Italian song, changed the words to be about, you know, come down to my shop and look at all our cool RVs. And my parents were mortified because it was not classy. And classiness really mattered. And so I think that there were things that, but they were not necessarily proxy for the black-white conversation. They were proxy for middle and upper class versus lower class. And they were influenced, I think, as white people growing up in the 60s by the colorblindness conversation. And so it was probably from their perspective, an advancement over the what may have been true in the houses that my grandparents ran, which may have included race conversations. But given my parents' age, living through the civil rights era, colorblindness was seen as the enlightened way to be. Oh, now we're all equal because they passed the Civil Rights Act. So everything's fine now. And so now all you black folks have to do is do what we Italians did in 1900 and just assimilate, because now all the doors are open to assimilation. Oh, you couldn't assimilate before because the doors weren't open to assimilation, but we've now opened the assimilation doors. All you have to do is walk through them. And so I think my parents, aside from the conversation you and I had about, but also be careful who you associate with, because it will reflect on you as a white woman. So I, you know, and I think then there was a huge gap in my evolution. Decades where I didn't think about, it didn't even occur to me I was white. I mean, I know the color of my skin, that's not what I mean, but I didn't have any construct called the white dominant culture. I knew racial disparities existed, especially in my field, right? The criminal legal field. But I really bought into the narratives of my childhood that we, and I have to tell you, there was something about Obama's election that I think still messed up the notion that somehow, and the growing wealth in pop culture of very small, okay, the door opening behind you is kind of creepy. It was sort of like a ghost. It's Halloween. We're filming this on Halloween.
That's my ghost. Don't be rocking the boat. It's cool.
We should have put, oh, well, costumes would make this very, very date specific, but I would have enjoyed seeing a new Halloween costume. I don't know. We should unpack that. But like, yes, if the point of our conversation was to bring us up into like sort of our upbringing. I think I can end with saying that, you know, when I went off to college, I'll tell you this last funny thing, but I think I've told you once before because we've known each other a bit. I had never met anyone else with my name, ever. And growing up, I had been told that my name was French. Okay. And the spelling of my name, maybe this is a French name, I have no idea, but I'd never met another Charisse in my life. I didn't particularly like having an unusual name, but I had one. Then I go to college. And there are, interestingly, there are two Black women on my floor in my dorm. It's a very white school, first of all. Predominantly white, certainly. But there are two Black women on my floor and they are housed together. I don't know if they knew each other before or not. Don't all Black people know each other?
Without a doubt. What are you talking about?
So
that's where the head nod comes in.
Her name was Charisse, spelled Sherreece. I'll never forget it because it called up for me so many of the tropes from my childhood around class. And had her parents been educated, they would have spelled it correctly and not phonetically. Oh, well, gross. But anyway, her boyfriend used to come visit her on the floor, but men weren't allowed to walk on our floor. They had to stay at the entrance. This is in the 1920s or something. No, it's not. I lived in a, my dorm was co-ed, which was the first year ever on my campus that the dorm was co-ed, and we were co-ed by floor. So he would come from another floor. He would stand at the end of the hallway and he would yell, "Hey, Charisse.
Hey, Charisse."
And I would know he wasn't talking to me.
How'd you know he wasn't talking to you? How did you know? The first time you heard him yell, "Hey, Charisse," how did you know he wasn't
calling?
Well,
the first time he yelled, "Hey, Charisse," I did stick, she and I stuck our heads out at the same time, right across the hall from each other. And I took one look at her and she took one look at me and I was like, he must be talking to you.
I love it.
I think it was the way he said Charisse.
I'm sure it was.
It made me think it wasn't for me.
It wasn't for you. Well, you often when I talk about you, people assume that you are a woman of color.
Yeah.
You know, and then when it comes out in conversation, because I don't identify you, they're like, "What? She's?" I'm like, "Yeah."
I know. I just think there's something really funny about that right now, like in the work that I'm doing and all this stuff. And I have a very complicated relationship to my name, but it is, I have met more Charisses of color than I have white Charisses for sure.
Have you met another white Charisse?
Yeah, I have.
Wow.
Yeah, I have. And it is,
I have never.
Yeah, it's with some shock that when I see, I'm like, "Your name is Charisse."
Whoa, get out of here.
Get out of here.
Get out of here.
Yeah, so. So I didn't have, I think I just went through lots of periods of time in which I didn't really think about race very much at all. And so then, you know, we'll get into some of our adult developmental years later, but that was.
What is interesting is you bring up two pivot points, and I don't know which one I want to explore, because I think they're both really interesting, right? I think I'm going to chase the second one first.
Okay.
Because, and we don't have to go into detail, but I think it foreshadows some of the conversations I expect us to have in the near future. Because you talked about not contemplating your whiteness. And I think that is so common. I'm making an assumption here because I don't know, because I'm Black, but my experience has been that is kind of the common position of most white people. Like, I never contemplated my whiteness. And here is where my position sometimes becomes challenging, right? Because I say, yeah, I get it. So now if I want to pull you into a group, because you know, there's so much, well, I've got some stories to tell you that happened this week, but I pull you into a group and I sit you down and I say, hey, white people in this group, you got all this white privilege up in you. You're just oppressing all the black people. And you're like, wait, what? Right? Because you hadn't even considered, because why should you have considered it? Because it's just the way you lived and the way you grew up and how life was. So how do you feel as you look back and you say those words that I had no reason to consider my whiteness? What does that bring to you in terms of what you know now and the work that you're doing now?
Well, you know, when someone said to me in 2018 or 19, oh, you don't know you're white. This was a black woman. I was like, wait, what? So I'm with you. Like, the first time I thought about it, I was like mortified that it had not occurred to me, right? And I felt embarrassed and all the things, because it did sort of feel like someone was saying, like, pointing out this pimple on my face that I should have known was there, right? But when you think about the way the systems are designed, if you fall into the default category, why would you ever know? How could you ever notice it, right? So, like, the first time I met someone who was left-handed, I was like, whoa, that's weird. And I went to a school that worked really hard. In grade school, they really tried hard to turn left-handed people into right-handed people.
That's a great analogy for at some point.
So I didn't notice that everything was designed for right-handed people. Scissors, doors, like, the world is designed for right-handedness. And we've tried different methods of getting left-handed people to become right-handed people, or to at least be ambidextrous so that you can operate in a right-handed world. I think the same is true for sexuality. Heterosexuality is the default setting. And so the first time I ever became aware as a child that someone was in relationship with someone of the same gender, I was like, whoa, that's weird. So when you're, now the thing I didn't ever have to come to grips with was that I knew my gender was not in the default setting. And so the being taught how the world works from my family was really around how the world works, because it was designed for and by men. They never used those words, but my mother would say things like, men run everything. And so if you want to get ahead in this world, you got to be a better man than men are. Learn how to be a better man than men are. My mother's phrase always was, beat them at their own game.
Their own game.
Beat them at their own game. Find out how the game, I'll tell you how the game is played. We'll learn how the game is played. And then your job is not to try to change the game because the game's unfair. Your job is to just be really, really, really good at that game. And so I didn't have to think about whiteness at the time. I thought I was, you know, when I was really young, I thought I was straight. So I didn't have to think about heteros, you know, that was just the default setting. So, but I knew that I knew that I wasn't a dude, and I was going to have to figure out how to traverse the distance between whatever the innate characteristics of being a female were, psychological, emotional, whatever, understanding that those were not the right way to be, emotional, you know, all the things. Women don't survive in the cutthroat world of men. And so I would just be cutthroat. So I didn't have to contemplate it. And I do think that, I don't know that we make much progress when we berate people or shame people for not noticing I sort of feel different now about saying that, because as I was thinking about you saying that, I was thinking, who in 2024 could you pull into a group somewhere and be like, did you know you were white? And they'd be like, I didn't know that. Never thought about it. Because the last 4 years have been so intense in our national dialogue around race. And for better or worse, Trump has brought that down into a micro level in rural communities that maybe it wouldn't have otherwise gotten to if this had still been a very left-wing liberal conversation hosted by Democrats in California and New York, right? So who, I don't know who you're pulling into a group now. The real dialogue I think that I look forward to talking to you about too is about what does white privilege mean?
What does white privilege mean? I think that is going to be part of our foundational structure of conversation. And yet, if, we're not getting here today, but before we go there, I'm really interested in this notion that yes, I can pull a white person or white people into a group today, and they're not surprised when I say, you're white. However, I believe that what still is something that people haven't integrated into their way of thinking is what does that mean for me as a white person? I know I'm white and I'm white and I'm liberal, let's say, right? And so I'm the same as you. One of the things that was said in our video by Gina, and she talked about not being followed in a store. Right, as part of her privilege. And I remember as a little boy going to Woodward and Lothrop, right, which was at the time one of the anchor big stores. I loved going in the Woodies, right? I loved walking around the Woodies, and my mom went to Woodies all the time. And she would let me venture off and just walk around. And I remember there was a bell that I would hear constantly, ding, ding. And she's like, anywhere in the store I went, there was the bell. I'm like, that's really cool. Like, this bell is always around me. It was years later that I realized that that bell was alerting the store security that this black kid is unattended and walking through the store. And it was so part of the culture and experience of shopping that I didn't notice it. And so when we look at this question, right, when we pull people into a room and say, white people, we say, hey, and they're like, cool, yeah, I'm white and I get it. I'm like, okay, do you really get it? Because my entire life was predicated on the idea that I have to know that I'm black at all times, because to forget you're black is to put yourself in danger. You have to be on alert and aware. And I had to develop this art of disarming, right? People who didn't look like me. I couldn't be a threat. And, so language became important to me, the tonality of my voice, how I communicate, humor to be able to disarm. All these things I realize now were survival techniques. And when you are white, you may develop those techniques because they may happen. But you don't have to. You get to just live in the world.
Well, yes, about race, but not about other intersecting identities, right? And so, yeah, but so I think the path, so for me, sometimes in talking with white people, another place where sometimes I have felt like folks get mad at me for the grace that I afford in this conversation around other discriminated against identities. We all like to say we're not playing the trauma Olympics, right? But I in some DEIA spaces, I haven't, some people are excellent at being able to facilitate a conversation in which we ask white people to think about their totality of their identities. Their ethnicity as a white person, Italian, Irish, Polish, French, whatever. the totality of their identities, including ethnicity, ability, disability, gender orientation, you know, the things that sort of are protected class kind of stuff that people have interest in. Class is not a protected class, but on the intersection wheel, when you think about all the things, class and the socioeconomic status you grew up with, all of these things make up our identities. And yet, I think one of the biggest disservices we do to kids is not support them in school on like actual healthy identity development. And so by the time you get told you're white, and you are understanding that a lot of harm has been caused by people with that identity, even if you yourself don't feel like you've participated in harm, you get defensive, being sort of like guilt by association. And you also realize, well, shit, there's nothing I can do about this skin. And so how do I develop a healthy white identity? And is that an oxymoron? Because sometimes in these DEIA conversations, just being white is synonymous with bad.
Yeah. And Charisse, I believe this is our work, right? Because if I am going to put myself in someone else's shoes, and I have to see my whiteness as bad, if I'm being told that or that's being implied, am I open for the dialogue that needs to happen for us to find our commonality, which is humanity? I say no. Or I say it is at least, you know, facing barriers.
Yeah.
You know, what happens emotionally when you're told you're quote unquote bad, or you are the cause of a thing, or you are responsible, and not putting it into a context that makes sense?
And
you know, I think
that your mere existence means that every day you walk in spaces with your whiteness, and it by the virtue of its existence, it causes harm, even if you say or do nothing. And so it's a boxed in feeling of like, well, what am I supposed to do? And so I do think it presents this barrier to conversation where, and yet at the same time, I understand it, because for so long it has gone unacknowledged. And so the demand for acknowledgement of white people have run this country and ruined the lives of many generations of people of color, both interpersonally and systemically. Like, that's never been, I mean, we just had Biden, right? President Biden just apologized hundreds of years later, even though it was still happening not that long ago, the Indian boarding schools, right? Literally just apologizing to the indigenous people of this country for having stolen, abused, and attempted to make white indigenous children.
Yeah, make those left-handed people right-handed.
We just apologized for it in 2024, right? And the same apology has not happened for slavery, right? So I understand why there's a desire on a part of a lot of Black folks to say, you got to first acknowledge that harm has happened and that people who look like you are responsible for that harm.
What part does or do people of color play in this dynamic? I mean,
not for me to say. I don't know, Kelton, let me ask you the question. Kelton, what role do Black folks play in that dynamic?
This is the third rail, right? This, now we're talking about the third rail, you know, and we don't go close to that because it's too hot. In any, from the way that I have been trained in my Gestalt training, in any trauma situation, those who perpetrate the trauma, those who are victims of the trauma, then create a dynamic where we are both bringing something into the space. And it is important that we begin to realize, understand, and deal with the reality that these cycles of trauma are not just fully the responsibility of one side of this equation. That if I continue to, let's say, as an example, if I continue to see myself as a victim, then do I contribute to the dynamic of being a victim or being victimized? We tell people in bad relationships all the time, you can't be a victim. You have to give up the role of victim and become active in your own healing process, right? So that you can shift from this role that you've now accepted as your role to be in a space that is going to be a more healthy space, a space where you can flourish, where you can thrive. We'll tell somebody in a relationship that in a heartbeat, in a love relationship or a friendship or whatever that is, we hesitate to say this as people of color to ourselves. And I am terrified in this moment to bring it up, right? Yeah. Because the pushback is so brutal sometimes in this arena, right? And you and I had this conversation when you asked me to be a part of IDEA, and we talked about it, and I'm like, all right, am I going to bring my truth? And I really love what Erica said to me in one of our meetings, you know, from her position on the board. And she's like, yo, you got to stand in your blackness. You got to bring your truth. And I'm like, okay, like I can bring my truth and I'm willing to bring my truth. I am now bringing my truth into a dynamic where we're going to have real conversation.
Yeah.
And we're doing a podcast that I don't know who's going to hear. And I had to ready myself and steady myself for what I'm anticipating to be backlash. Oh, blacklash. Oh, I like that. Blacklash. That was a Freudian slip that made sense.
Yeah. So it's really interesting that you draw this parallel to the bad relationship conversation. I was in class last week, and one of my colleagues in my PhD program, her focus is on intervening in domestic violence.
Mm.
And I think she's doing amazing work. And I don't know enough about it, but it left me curious because the conversation was very heavily focused on interventions with the domestic violence victims, as if getting them, this may not be what her work is at all, by the way, I actually don't know. But what I was thinking about it is that a lot of the common narrative in that space is if we just get this typically female victim away from this typically male abuser, this typically female victim will go on to be healthy and happy and successful. We just get her away from this guy, right?
Yeah.
And if you've ever been friends as a female with women in shitty relationships, you watch them go from one shitty relationship to the next because their own work isn't done around why am I drawn to situations where I allow myself to be treated this way. I am not trying to draw the ire of domestic violence advocates who will say you get trapped in a thing and the economic, you know, the children, the economics, the threat of violence, all of that I'm totally down with. I get it. I understand it. I have a person in my family who is a survivor of domestic violence. But her own view of herself was what allowed her to enter into a relationship and stay in one that was dangerous for her. Her own need to heal was about childhood stuff, not we're drawn to situations that are ironically familiar, even if they're toxic for us. And so I love the parallel because there's work for both parties to do.
Yeah.
And one may be more overt because it's something you can see, that kind of violence, whether it's physical or emotional or financial abuse, whatever that is, it's easier to see than the work that needs to be done by folks who find themselves in that situation so that they don't repeat those patterns for themselves, right? And so, yes, I'm grateful that you're brave enough to have these conversations. They don't have to be popular conversations. And no, nothing we're saying is the truth. We're all talking out of our ass on this subject. But
yeah.
I think what we're trying to do is be curious. Okay, listen, if we've tried all these other things, what haven't we tried yet, right? And just to put a plug in for one of the books that I hope we'll talk about in a later episode, but there's a book called Emotional Justice. And I discovered it at a conference that I went to recently. And the thing that drew me so much to the book was because there are chapters that are, here's the emotional work that white people need to do. Here's the emotional work that Black people need to do. And maybe she doesn't go as deep into that victimization kind of conversation as you're about to bring or will bring in another episode, if that's where we head. But really important to at least try to unpack. I don't know. What if there is work for you to do? What does that work even look like? And how do we just stop this dance, right? We're in this tango that just doesn't ever seem to end.
Well, you know, this gets so heavy. I'm just going to throw some things out because I think these are things that we're going to have to unpack as we go along, right? So one of the dynamics as we, as people of color, as Black folk, don't talk about in this discussion of privilege, it's like our own internal discrimination, right? So I grew up when it was like, you were red bone or you were Black, right? A red bone was a person who was fair in complexion, right? And the more fair you were, the more red you were called. You were red. They called you red, right? Maybe your hair was like brown. You could be a male or female to be a red bone, right? But there was a lot of talk about red boneness and this almost kind of attraction to the red bone individual in society. So that's me. That's like in the 60s, right? Prior to that, there was this privilege, of course, of being fairer, because during the period of slavery, you were more likely to be in the house, right? Also, there was this period of time, my great grandmother was part of it. She rode on the front of the bus because she did not look Black. So there was a privilege that came with that. My grandmother, when my sister at age 28 introduced her boyfriend to her, said, he's too Black, right? Because my grandmother was fair. My sister was fair, way fairer than me. Way fairer than me. And then there's my grandmother saying that this man that my sister is dating is too freaking Black. So there are all these layered nuances within our own community. Just 2 days ago, I am with a young man of age 27, 29. He's playing a video game online with headphones on. He's playing against another Black man who is very fair. The Black man who's fair says something N-word. The young man that I'm with says, why aren't you saying the word? He says, I can't say it. The guy that I'm with says, why? You can't say it because you're light, because you're fair? He said, no, if you're going to be with me, you're going to say the word. So I'm watching this dynamic between two Black men arguing over whether they should say the N-word or not. And one is not saying, I don't want to say it because it carries connotations that are, no, he's like, I'm light, I'm fair, you're dark, so I don't want to say it to you. What do we still have to unpack within our own selves? It is so complicated. And yet we show up to the table and we're going to ask white folk to do it immediately. There is so much dialogue, conversation, and work to be done with self. And this is, and I'll kind of truncate now, because the emotional components to this, to the individuality of this, is where we have to start. We've got to start doing work as individuals in emotional work. In order to be in touch with what we're feeling, what we're experiencing, we understand societal trauma, family trauma, individual trauma. We understand those concepts. Where am I as the individual emotionally? And how do I show up for a conversation given my emotional state?
Well, and you and I have talked about, you know, at my old, you sort of, we met as I was coming out of a job in which we had done a lot of work on racial equity internally as an organization. We'd had a lot of difficult conversations. Not all of them had gone well. And I was pretty raw after that experience. And I remember having conversations with you about my experience and you saying things I didn't expect you to say. I assumed you would think that kind of the narrative that was happening in my organization and in my other spaces where Black folks were, I mean, I wasn't privy to what was happening in the affinity space that they were in, right? But in the multicultural space, my feeling was like, we're here because white people have something to do. They have work to do. We Black folks are willing to participate in watching your work, white people. But our work is really only about having a space for us to complain to each other about what white people are doing around the office, to provide some comfort to each other in response to yesterday's microaggressions on behalf of some of the white people in this office. And we as white folks were being asked to challenge and unpack our entire socialization around who we think Black folks are, our own complicity in maintaining status quo systems of oppression, understanding our own heritage and lineage. How far back do I have to go before I find a slave owner in my family? Lots of really tough work that is challenging, asking me to challenge my entire perception of the world, right? The inverse didn't feel like it was happening, right? And so I once said to you, if I only thought of Black folks in the way I have ever understood them to be from the news, I would still think a certain way about Black folks, right? How do you know the stuff you know about white people? If we live in this really segregated world, how do you know what you know about white people? Well, you have history passed down to you, right? Narratives in your family, people telling you, listening to stories of your grandparents or aunts and uncles or whatever, talking about whitey, right?
Oh, yeah.
You have direct experience, basically, of police who are predominantly white, historically predominantly white. And then you have what you see on the news about the treatment of Black folks by white folks. So what other image of white folks could you have other than we as a lot are dangerous, ignorant, violent people with no charm, no senses of humor, and no variety amongst us in terms of how we think, right?
Don't leave out no rhythm, because that's a real big deal for me.
Well, I have tons of rhythm. You've seen me dance. You have seen me dance. Don't even, you know, I'm not, that is one area that I refuse to go in. Except I do remember when we went dancing and you were one of the only Black folks There, all the white women wanted to dance with you because you could dance. Remember at the disco thing? Yeah.
Disco night. Yeah, I do remember
That was
that.
so tropey. It was so stereotypical. These white women from the suburbs, downtown, to hear some disco music, wanted to go home and tell, I danced with this black guy who had moves.
Look, it's tropey, but it's my experience. I mean, I have always gone to across those lines to clubs that were not typically clubs that were black. And I'll tell you get to walk into a club that's predominantly white, you get to be the best dancer in the room. Lots of dances for you, buddy.
Okay, well, I can dance, but we're going to talk about that another time. So keep going, because where we were headed was talking about kind of what is the work for Black folks to do in this space. Not my role, not my job to say, but what we've been doing around DEIA has met with some variations of effectiveness. So we're just trying to think about new spaces and you've given this some thought, so what do you think the work is?
So, I'm going to answer it by telling another story. There was, and I wish I had the information in front of me, and maybe I don't need to out these people in terms of what they're doing. There was a conference this yes th that yesterday. There was a mixer. The conference was scheduled for in November. This is an organization who does DEI work, and I think last year in or in 2022. They were sold out.
Yeah.
I mean, they were packed. People from corporations, all walks of life and business, everybody was filtering in. They were doing great work. They were hosting it again this year, and I think they tracked over 10,000 hits on their website. People viewing what they were presenting and offering. And they had 50 people.
What?
50 people,
As compared to how many?
like 500 the first in 2022.
Oh my
They
God.
couldn't even take any more people in. So what that says to me is that we are seeing a shift in the willingness for people to bring this work in. And I believe that a huge part of that reasoning is because the work has been lopsided. A lopsided lift. And I
That's
believe.
not what they say, right? In the news and in the research articles, they all point to the fact that the reasons why these DEIA efforts get derailed is because of the fragility of the white people.
Yeah, and that's an easy out. See, for me, that's an easy out. I could look at the fragility of white people. I can look at the climate politically. With what Trump has brought into play, which, by the way, I don't necessarily see as a bad thing. It's a difficult thing, but anytime light is shown on a problem and people come out of the dark, we know where the players are, right? I can't help but.
He's also contributed a little bit of that to the discussions of patriarchy and misogyny.
Oh, without a doubt, without a doubt, without a doubt. But I can't help but to fantasize in my downtime of what the movement would have been if we had walked in the door and said, "Wow, folks, we find ourselves at an intersection in our lives where we are polarized, and we're understanding now the polarization. We're understanding the trauma that we're all part of. How do we sit together and take this journey?" How do we, right, without pointing fingers, without blame, sit together and try to figure this out on an equal plane? Look, I get it. I get it. If for so long you have been denied access and the attitude of, look, Whitey, you need to understand, sit up and change, there was a place for that. When you can't vote, when you can't stay at a hotel, when you can't drink from a water fountain. No, it's not a time to do any exploration of our emotional selves. I need to freaking be able to vote. So no, there's no time for this discussion. I'm going to march in the streets. I'm going to throw rocks at things. I'm going to raise my voice to a pitch that it cannot be ignored. Right? But we can't exist at that feverish level 100% of the time. So I'm not saying we arrived anywhere. What I'm saying is we reach a point where we have to all breathe and say, okay, we got some basic stuff worked out. Some basic stuff, a lot of work to do. Got some basic stuff worked out. Let's now begin to try to shoulder up and take the rest of this journey together instead of standing on opposite sides of the street yelling at each other.
Yeah, but what would you say then to people who say, yeah, okay, well, yeah, you can, I'm allowed to vote and I'm allowed to stay at a rest at a hotel and I can eat at a restaurant and I can even marry interracially. But you haven't made up for all, like I'm starting from way down at the opposite end of the field, still trying to hit that goal, but I have so much catch up to do. Because I have no intergenerational wealth, because I'm still living in segregated parts of town, because the barriers to my success are not, they're not my individual barriers to overcome. They are also systemic barriers that still exist. The way we fund public schools, for example, right? The disparity between lending at banks that is still existing today. Like some of the things you said, you don't, some people would argue with you that those basics, some of the disparity is that still exists in those basics is just more hidden from
No,
us.
you're absolutely right, and you make a great point. And those people who
It's
would argue
police.
that
What
would
about the
be,
police still killing people who look like you?
and all those arguments are valid, and right. So I'm not saying we don't stand up and say no, you can't keep shooting this in the streets. I'm not saying no, we can't say that the gerrymandering that's happening for voting purposes can't continue. I'm not saying that we can't raise our voices to that. I'm saying and, right? There's an and here. And I think that for far too long, we've been operating with the but or until. So I'm not going to take this journey with you. I'm not going to do any emotional work with you until you correct all these other things. Well, I think part of the path of correcting those things is for us finding ourselves and aligning ourselves and our humanity. When we begin to align ourselves in our humanity, you see me differently, I see you differently, we find some commonality. And yeah, that's a slow road. It is not an overnight answer. You know, I remember having a conversation with a Mormon friend of mine. She was a nurse, we were working night shift and got to be very close. And I was very close with she and her husband. And I remember her crying one night. Because we were having this discussion about kind of like, well, we didn't call it white privilege at the time, but kind of about a white privilege conversation. And I was talking about some of the challenges that I would face. I was young at the time because I wanted to be this explorer of the world, right? I want to just travel and explore. And some of my concerns of that being black, she was talking about how she didn't feel that at all being white. She then reflected on this same exact experience you had. Where her parents were like, we're all equal. And she came home with a black male friend, not a boyfriend, a black male friend. And her family was like, you know, you can't bring him here. You can't hang out with him. You can't associate with him. She was able to move forward, and we had this beautiful relationship because she saw my humanity and I saw hers. That's a turning point. This woman and her husband, they will raise their children differently. I'm not saying their kids won't come up with some white privilege, and they of course they will, but maybe less than they had. And I think that we have to play the long game here. While we are demanding immediate change in how we are policed, while we're demanding immediate change in how our communities are carved up, all that stuff, yeah, we're doing that, and we have our eye on the long game. And for me as a therapist, as a clinician, the long game is our emotional work that we have to do to begin to change this thing at its core.
Well, I think that we should put a pin in this for now because we're approaching the top of the hour, but I want to come back in a future episode to this conversation around what is the relationship between interpersonal work and systemic work, right? Because a lot of the conversation in the space talks about, and in my field, I'll just say it in my field, in the criminal legal field, I have had conversations with folks who work on racial equity who say, we don't talk about implicit bias anymore. We don't talk about interpersonal stuff. We focus on helping people who work in systems understand the cause of disparity, racial disparities in their numbers, and how the policies, some of the systemic and institutional policies, are driving those disparity numbers. And we set goals for equity or, some balance representation, that people are not overrepresented in a sample of arrests or incarceration or anything. And we don't deal with their emotional, we don't deal with their feelings, we don't deal with their thoughts about Black folks. We just try to help them focus on changing policy. And if you look at what some folks say is this kind of like successful model, although if you ask any LGBTQIA plus person, they might think differently. The move for marriage equality didn't focus on changing hearts and minds as a way to change policy. It used the legal structure and going all the way to the Supreme Court to get marriage equality. And many of the advocates and activists in the space would say, I don't care what you think about me. Just let me have my rights. Think what you want. Let me vote. Think what you want about me. Let me stay in that hotel, right? Like change the policies and practices. And maybe by exposure, desegregation and exposure, you will grow to have a different opinion of me. But I don't effing care because I have my rights and that's what I wanted. So we should come back and talk about kind of how we think about the connection between the interpersonal and the systemic work, in addition to more deeply diving into what are the ways in which actual cross-racial dialogue happens. Because that's another complaint, right, of this DEIA movement is that this notion that we're not still even able to have honest and authentic relationships. And I have had people say to me, your relationship with Kelton, your friendship with Kelton, you can think about it all ways you want, but it's not real. It'll never be a real friendship because of the power differential between you. You will always be white and he will always be black.
And I remember you having that conversation with me, and I remember the hurt I felt in that conversation, that there would be somebody out there who would feel that two human beings could not come together and have an honest emotional exchange to grow close, to love, appreciate, and respect on a plane that was equal. Are there moments when we're together that I see your white privilege? Yeah, I mean, you and I have been in restaurants, we've been plenty of places. They haven't been overt moments, but at the same time, that's real life. And you and I, what makes us able to have the relationship they don't think we have is because we can then talk about it. I don't hold on to that. I don't want to talk to Charisse about that. I can talk openly about it. And you're not going to judge me for what I'm feeling or what I'm seeing. Well, you're going to sit back and say, wow, let's look at that. Let's unpack it. Let's talk about it. How am I feeling about that? How are you feeling about that? And that's what I'm talking about. So yeah, I think you're absolutely right. We're gonna circle back. And my big word in all of this is and. That and, right? And I believe if we can start saying and, we can really make some changes happen.
Yeah, I agree. All right, people. Well, thank you for sitting through episode two. No. Episode one, part two.
Episode one, part two.
So
True.
thanks, Kelton. And we'll see you next time on Emotionally Correct.
Emotionally
Hilarious.
correct.
I don't know how hilarious we were today, but
We got really deep, you know. Yeah, so I don't know.
That's all right.
A hilarious and deep podcast.
True, true. All right.
Okay.
Bye.